In a world of marketing and hyperbole, we're frequently challenged to figure out what is real, especially with consumer products. Is that thing we just bought really new and improved? But there are many other realms that push the bounds of truth, sometimes completely over the edge. Our guest this hour can help us sharpen our skills for detecting the cases in which people are stretching or even breaking the truth. It's a good time to sharpen those skills when you think about it. We're surrounded by claims and counterclaims about candidates and ballot measures, and that's only going to increase for the next few weeks. Daniel J. Levitin is an award-winning scientist, musician, author, and record producer, and the author of several best-selling books. The previous book, The Organized Mind, brought him to the Jefferson Exchange last November. Daniel is dean of social sciences at the Minerva School in San Francisco and teaches at the Center for Executive Education at UC Berkeley. His PhD is from the University of Oregon. His new book is called A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. Daniel Levitin, welcome back to the Exchange.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
As I was saving my notes, I ran across an earlier set of notes called Field Guide to Manzanitas. How is this a field guide?
The Manzanitas one or mine?
Yours.
Well, I wanted to write something that would be a very practical aid to people who are walking through the, let's say, the landscape of lies and deceptions and be able to tell one from another in terms of like a taxonomy or a typology, and be able to help them distinguish what they're looking for from something that they don't want. You know, I spent a lot of time in Oregon. I went to the University of Oregon and used to go on the mushroom hunt. And, of course, we would bring these field guides to make sure that the mushrooms we got weren't toxic. And I think information is the same way.
Absolutely. But it's really interesting to think about the fact that in today's world, in the information age, where so much is available to us so quickly, you know, you can find that many home runs Willie Mays hit in 1965 in about 5 seconds just by going online. You would think that in that plethora of information, lying would be harder, but it's not, is it?
It's kind of ironic, isn't it? Yeah. The promise of the Internet was that it was going to be this great democratizing force that brought all the world's great wisdom to everybody in their homes. You know, we've got access to more information than contained in the Library of Alexandria and the Library of Congress combined. And yet, there's been a proliferation of misinformation and pseudo-facts and counter-knowledge and just outright lies because the Internet doesn't distinguish. There's no gatekeeper. And so people whose views are fringy and might not otherwise have a platform now have one. And it's so easy, of course, to go into a website, grab a quote, and then change it, and then reproduce it and put it on Facebook, and people forward it, and nobody's looking at the original source anymore. You know, it was harder to do that in the old days. It's not like I could take an article from the Oregonian or the New York Times 30 years ago and take a word out and still have it look like there was not a word missing.
Right.
But, you know, in the digital age, that's not only possible, it's what a lot of people do.
Well, true. When you think about the democratization, it means that Joe the plumber, just to use one example, has as much chance to get a website out there as ABC News.
Right. And Joe the plumber actually is going to be really right about a lot of things. Where else would I be able to get expert plumbing advice or electrical advice or construction advice for free from somebody who's been doing it for a long time? The problem is if Joe the plumber starts talking about what he thinks is wrong with the tax codes, he may or may not have the expertise in that.
Hmm. Interesting. You say misinformation is very old, Daniel, dating back to ancient times, but you also say it's promiscuous. What does that mean?
Well, what I mean by that is that misinformation consorts with people of all social and educational classes. It's not at all picky about who it sticks to. And it propagates, and you know, it propagates like a disease. The very smallest provocation can cause you to disseminate it yourself. You see an interesting story on social media, you forward it to your friends, they forward it to their friends. Pretty soon, it's a story that may never have been authenticated.
Interesting. Yeah, I noticed that a fair amount, though, people putting things out there. Can you believe this happened? And then you go to Snopes.com and you realize it's already been debunked months before.
Well, and there was a reporter at a major U.S. newspaper who ran a story about a fake tweet from a congressman who didn't exist.
Oh, wow. Oh, and come to think of it, I was just remembering now it was a Pierre Salinger. His career at ABC News ended when he relayed some internet information about the jet that crashed off eastern Long Island.
Yeah.
About a ground-to-air missile or something, and it was never proven true, and got himself fired for that.
Well, because we expect a lot from the experts. The professionally trained investigative journalists have the training and the job requirement of trying to get to the bottom of a story, which is why it can take a news outlet like CNN or the New York Times a while to report on a story. I don't know if Brangelina is such a major story that it would need to be covered in a major paper, but take Michael Jackson's death. The mainstream media, NPR, American Public Media, the PRI in the radio world, CNN, CBS News in the television world, New York Times, Washington Post, all of these sources that we rely on were late to the story of Michael Jackson's death. It was broken by TMZ because they were willing to run a story before they had confirmation. And the interesting thing here is that they got that one right, but they get a whole lot wrong. And each one of us has to decide how we want to deal with this. In my life, I'm willing to wait a little while to get the news and know that it's right.
Right. It's almost like TMZ is the broken clock that's right twice a day.
That's a wonderful analogy, yes.
All right, much more to talk about with Daniel Levitin. His book is called A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. We haven't asked yet if it's time to coincide with the election, but it's a good thing that it's here now, isn't it? We'll come back and talk more with Daniel and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Daniel J. Levitin, scientist, musician, author many times over, record producer as well. His latest book, out just about 3 weeks ago, is called A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. As we've already acknowledged, in the age of the Internet, you can get a lot of information out there and a lot of misinformation as well. How to tell them apart is the goal of the book. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join this conversation and give some thought to things that you have seen that you thought, I don't think so, but how do I know? 800-838-3760. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. Daniel, is it deliberate that this is arriving as we hit to the heart of campaign season?
Well, not exactly. I've been working on the book since 2001, collecting examples and trying to polish it and make it accessible to the modern reader who doesn't necessarily have a lot of time for theory and just wants the advice. But I finished writing the book in March, and my publisher and I talked about when would be a good time to put it out. And we figured, September is probably not bad.
Right around Labor Day when the campaigns really begin in earnest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I want to emphasize here that I've tried to be apolitical with the book and the examples I've chosen. There's one Trump and one Hillary example, and then there's a couple of others that might be seen as political. But really, I wanted to keep politics out of it because I don't want to pretend to be telling people what to think. Mm-hmm. That's not my job. I just want to give them the tools to help them evaluate evidence so they can form their own conclusions.
Well, the how to think is really the major part of this, and it is very fair. I do have to agree with you there.
Well, I think it must be because I've gotten an equal number of irate letters from people on both sides.
I have to wonder, though, if you've been working on this since 2001, it seems like every time you probably have a great example in each category, another one comes along.
And I got to thank Fox News for that.
Okay, I will point out that Fox News does show up a few times in here for examples of how things are done badly. The book gets into evaluating numbers first and then words later. I mean, do we tend to give statistics and figures a little more weight or a little more respect?
We do, and I pick on Fox News for distorting graphs, but for just to show that I'm fair and balanced, I pick on the New York Times a bit too.
Okay.
The problem with numbers is that we tend to think that they are facts, and we tend to think of statistics as facts, and they're not. They're collected by people who can make mistakes and have their own biases, who can massage the data or present you only a small part of the picture and not the whole part. And all I aim to do is to get people to stop and think for 15 seconds. You know, could there be another side of the story here? So here's an example, Jeff. Suppose I say, you're familiar, I guess, with the claim that 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate.
Oh, of course, yes, yeah.
Well, so it turns out Colgate got sued for that ad campaign. And the reason is that it's somewhat misleading. When you hear it, I think the average person thinks, well, you know, the other toothpastes are not being recommended 4 out of 5 times. Colgate must really be better. And, of course, the first thing I think of when I hear something like that is, who were these dentists?
Mm-hmm.
Do they still have their licenses? Are they currently practicing? Are they on the payroll of the Colgate people? So that's one question. How many did they ask? Did they only literally ask 5? Or, you know, or did they ask 500 and 400, you know, giving the said Colgate, giving them the proportion? But the lawsuit hinged on this implication that the other toothpastes aren't any good. It turned out that the dentists were allowed to name as many toothpastes as they wanted. And so, yes, 4 out of 5 of them recommended Colgate, but they recommended Crest and Gleam and Aquafresh and, you know, all the rest.
Oh, interesting. So Colgate was just in a flock, but they chose to just cite themselves.
Yeah, so they're giving you, it's not exactly untrue, but it is a distortion of the truth.
Well, you know, a lot of this starts with plausibility, which gets to the point of what we bring to the transaction when we are the receivers of things that are presented as facts.
Absolutely. We have to, I think critical thinking, evidence-based thinking means that you don't cynically reject every claim you hear, but you don't gullibly accept them either. You just ask yourself, is this plausible? So, as an example, you know, if you know that there are roughly 7 billion people in the world, if somebody tells you, I just read that 10 billion people in the world don't have internet, you know, that's not plausible.
Right. Okay. And but the other ones that you point out too that are a bit more subtle than that, like, you know, that something has doubled every year for the last 30 years, and as you point out, you start getting into numbers that are impossible.
Oh yes, doubling goes up very quickly. This was a claim made by the anti-marijuana folks that in the 35 years since marijuana laws in the state of California stopped being enforced, the number of marijuana smokers in that state doubled every year. Now, if you don't stop and think about it, it might occur to you that that's plausible, but it doesn't take more than half a minute, and using nothing more than, you know, third grade math to work through this. So let's do that. Let's take the simple assumption that 35 years ago there was only one marijuana smoker in California.
Okay.
I mean, just to give the claim the benefit of the doubt. Conservative mm-hmm. assumption. Now, I can tell you, 35 years ago in California, there was probably more than one marijuana smoker in the building I'm in right now.
I would agree.
Let alone the whole state. But, yeah, okay, so you got one marijuana smoker in year one. Year two, you double it, so that's 2. The next year is 8, 16, 32, 64. You keep doubling the numbers, and pretty soon you exceed the number of people in the state of California. And by the time you get to year 35, you've exceeded the number of people in the world. So the claim doesn't pass this simple plausibility test.
You know, you do get on websites and news organizations, and you say it's tough to trust them to convey numbers that mean something. I mean, what are some of the general realms? I mean, obviously, if somebody just passes on a number like we just talked about, you know, the doubling of marijuana smokers over the years, if you don't question the numbers yourself and you're delivering them, you're going to run into problems. But, I mean, are we choosing bad data sets here or just repeating things that we haven't explored ourselves? What's the usual problem?
Can I choose all of the above?
Sure.
you know, a lot of times the people who make the graphs for TV have an artistic background. They're graphic artists, and they don't have a math background. So they don't stop and question the numbers they're given. And a lot of times reporters don't question the numbers they're given. I cite an example in the that appeared in the New York Times of a reporter, a business reporter, who really should have known better, but didn't stop and look at the numbers and realize that she had reported numbers that are nonsensical, having to do with the movement of businesses from one New England state to another, which you know, turned out not to be supported by the evidence. It's just that it's incumbent upon all of us, even the average citizen, to look carefully at these things and to hold journalists accountable.
Well, and there's a great example you give in here, too, about how percentages in particular can get warped, and it deals with something as mundane as our own salaries. You know, if your boss gives you a 50% pay cut and then gives you a 50% pay raise, it's not the same amount.
Right, right. So suppose you're making, $1,000 a week, and your boss says, I'm giving you a 50% pay cut, so that means he's going to take $500 away. Now you're getting $500 a week. And then, you know, a couple of months later, he says, well, I'm going to give you back the 50% I took away. I'll give you a 50% pay hike. Well, that 50% of your now $500 salary is only $250, so you're not all the way up. And it's because you're applying the percentage to a different baseline, is the technical way to describe it. And, you know, unless you stop and think about what's going on, you can be taken advantage of. People can, you know, bamboozle you, steal your money, get you to enter into bad business deals or bad life decisions. And I think the problem is that a lot of us are intimidated by numbers and don't feel that we have the tools to deal with them. And that's really what I want to change with the book. There's nothing in there that requires math. It's just simple arithmetic.
Daniel Levitin is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, neuroscientist, author, musician, record producer, you name it, he's probably done it. His latest book is called A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. Yes, we have a lot more information available to us, and yes, a lot of it is good, and then a lot of it is not as well. Join us on the Exchange. Ideas for ways in which you have encountered some numbers, facts or figures, or just words that made you think, wait a minute, I think I'm being bamboozled here. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. You have some helpful reminders here about averages and how to be aware of those, because there are the three kinds, mean, median, and mode. And then you give an example here, life expectancy, and how the numbers from the 19th century can give us some really wrong ideas.
Yeah, that's an interesting case. So we tend to think that people in the 1800s didn't live very long, because on average they didn't. But the problem with averages is they are a distortion. You're taking a whole bunch of numbers and collapsing them into a single number. In some cases, it's helpful to do that. In others, it obscures a difference that's important. So if you look at the average age of people in the 1800s, I don't remember off the top of my head what it was, but let's say it was 50 or so. You're averaging across two different groups of people. People in the 1800s really did live into their 70s. But there was a lot of child mortality, and so infant mortality and child mortality due to disease. We didn't have antibiotics back then, and we didn't have the germ theory of disease, so people weren't washing their hands and their wounds and things. So you're combining across a bunch of people who died before they reached maturity and a bunch of people who lived long natural lives and coming up with an average that makes you think that, you know, people were dying at 50, but they weren't.
Well, and there are other examples in here of ways in which figures are sort of twisted around, and it's not just with the ways in which averages can be skewed by outliers, but just the ways in which the information is presented. And of course, here's where Fox News shows up with a chart on the Bush tax cuts, and it's something you talk about as truncating one of the axes on the graph.
Yeah, so this is an interesting case. During the Obama administration, there were tax cuts put in place by the Bush administration. They were about to expire. There were arguments on both sides of whether they should be allowed to expire or not. And Fox News simply reported what would happen to the tax rate for many Americans if the cuts were allowed to expire. The tax rate would shift from 35% to 39.6%. It would go up. Now, how would you graph that? if you had a couple of bars and you had a vertical axis that went from 0 to 100%, you know, your first bar would climb up to 35%, what the tax rate is now. The next bar would be at 39.6. And you could visually see that your taxes were going to go up 4.6 percentage points, or about 13%. In other words, the difference between 35 and 39.6% is an increase of 13% in the tax you'd pay, approximately. But it doesn't make for a very impressive-looking graph. So the graph maker, instead of letting the axis, the vertical axis, go from 0 to 100%, started the axis at 34%. So now that bar that we're starting with at 35% is a tiny little sliver. And the new tax rate, if the cuts are allowed to expire, is looming over it at 39.6. And it looks like a six-fold difference in your tax rate. What this exploits is the idea that the human brain isn't very good at visualizing numbers or taking tables of numbers and turning them into an accurate impression. We're a visual species, so that picture makes a visual impression that's a deception and a distortion.
And as I read this part of the book, though, I thought, you know, we should be on to this, because there's one of a number of cartoons and old movies that make fun of the guy with the bad sales chart that he just turns sideways.
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. We should be onto it. But I think, you know, many of us are intimidated by numbers, by graphs. We don't want to take the 15 seconds to look at them carefully. I would say the next time you see a graph, look and see if the axes, that is those lines with little tick marks on them, look and see if there are actually numbers attached to them. A lot of times a graph won't have any numbers. And if there aren't any numbers, they can draw anything they want. And make it look any way they want it to look. And after you've seen if there are numbers, see if there are even units. Are you looking at sales figures in dollars or in cents or in units sold? Or if they aren't units, it could be the number of cupcakes that the person in the graphics department ate this month.
Well, you know, it's almost instantly effective, because I must admit, when I was looking at a couple of graphs last night unrelated to the book, I started looking at whether the axes actually started at zero and then what the increments were, whether they were consistent. If it goes, you know, by 30, by 30, by 30, by 40, then you realize that somebody's trying to skew the information at one end of the graph.
Well, that's the other thing. There are several examples in the book drawn from real-world examples where somebody just changes the increment in the graph midway, which gives you, and if you're not actually looking at the numbers, you don't notice it, but it can really distort the visual impression. And, you know, why does all this matter? Well, public policy decisions about money that should be given to school boards or to health centers, you know, public policy decisions are made on the basis of committee members who look at graphs like this and make a decision.
Let's take a call here. We have Paul in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Daniel Levitin, the author of A Field Guide to Lies. Hi, Paul.
I've got to start with one of my favorite quotes, and that's Benjamin Disraeli. There are lies, damn lies, and then there are statistics. And that
thank
gets right
you for
to
that.
It. I got reeled in on this very program a while back during the Malheur occupation. And in this situation, I had something that came across my news feed. It looked like legitimate news to me, came from a trusted source, and was later proven to be incorrect. That was the story of the high school wrestling coach. Back during that time, who supposedly wrestled one of the occupiers to the ground.
Oh, right.
And sent him packing. In any event, Are there some good fact-checking sites?
Places to go to look to find out what we're
there
talking
are.
About?
There yeah. are. So PolitiFact.com and FactCheck.com are very good for tracking what political candidates are saying and sourcing the comments. So if a candidate for office says, I voted against Bill 117, they'll go to the congressional record and tell you whether that's true or not. Or if a candidate says, you know, I did this or that, or I didn't say this or that, they'll source it for you and actually rate the statements. For non-political things, there's Snopes, S-N-O-P-E-S, S like Sierra, N-O-P like Peter, E-S like Sierra. Hoaxes.com, which helps to debunk a lot of internet hoaxes. And of course, you know, the mainstream media are imperfect. They do have their biases. I don't think that they're run by a secret cabal of like-minded conspirators who are trying to put one over on us. And I think that, you know, I'd play the percentages here. You're more likely to get accurate news from the mainstream legitimate media than from some blogger who's got a computer sitting in a basement somewhere.
Yeah, a little skepticism on the numbers you're given in the first place helps. We had our member of Congress on yesterday talking about the number of bills that had been sent out of the Congress to make it look like it was doing a lot of work. But, you know, when you think about the number of bills that they knew the Senate would actually take up, it's a different kind of story. I mean, you can pass, you know, 60 different versions of repeal Obamacare knowing that the other house won't take it up. It makes you look productive if you just count the raw numbers, but there's also some context to be had, too.
Absolutely.
All right, well, we'll pick it up on the other side of a break. Daniel Levitin's our guest on The Exchange. His book is A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. You probably have lots of examples you want to share with us. We want to hear from you. Join us by phone or by email on the other side of the break. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange with Daniel Levitin and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Daniel Levitin, award-winning scientist, musician, best-selling author. His latest book is called A Field Guide to Lies, out just in time for campaign season, but not specifically about politics. It's about looking for ways in which we can pierce through the flurry of stuff that's thrown at us, both in numbers and in words, and to be able to find our own truth in that. A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your comments and your examples as well. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's a special warning in here in the section about numbers about the infographic, which news organizations love. What should we look for in those?
Well, yeah, infographics are a funny thing. They're pictures that are meant to convey some numbers. And again, I think this is very useful in general. We are a visual species. We're a storytelling species. To be able to make a bunch of complex numbers, to turn them into a visual picture is very helpful to get most of us to understand what's going on with whatever claim it is. But it's also an area that's ripe for deception. You know, evil-minded or heavily biased tricksters can create infographics that deceive us rather than inform us. And these are a little bit harder to figure, but in the case I demonstrate in the book, there's a dollar bill showing what's happening due to inflation, that you're losing a percentage of your purchasing power. And the dollar bill is being cut at about just to the right of the halfway mark. There's a big scissors cutting the dollar bill, mm-hmm. showing you what part of your paycheck you're going to lose if something isn't done about it fast. If you measure it, the dollar bill's being cut at the 42% point. Now, if you're losing 42% of your paycheck to inflation and other fiscal policy problems, that's alarming. But the actual statistic wasn't 42%, it was 4.2%. It would be just the tiniest sliver of your dollar that you would want to show. But an unscrupulous artist drew it differently.
Yeah, that was a good example right there. There's just in general, though, and we're talking about not just visual representations, but when people begin to take sets of figures and try to stand them side by side, I mean, do you find often that that reporters and news organizations are sticking apples and oranges out there in the same general sets of data?
Yeah, that happens a lot. I mean, we talked about it with the longevity lifespan issue. A simple way to think about the apples and oranges with averaging and how an average can distort that is, suppose I tell you that there is a room next door that has five people in it and their average net worth is $10 billion. Now, that might be a room you want to go in for a variety of reasons, people whose average net worth is $10 billion. But if I tell you later that it's five, the five people, one of them is Mark Zuckerberg, and the other four are indigent people who have no, you know, no net worth, that changes the character of it. I've compared apples and oranges there.
Mm-hmm. There's an example you returned to a couple of times, which is more people have cell phones than toilets. What did you find that is wrong with that that claim?
So that's an interesting. It's an interesting case where whoever's reporting it has provided such a lack of specificity. It's difficult to know whether the claim is plausible or not. What does it mean? If the way it was actually reported was, I think more people have access to cell phones than toilets. And that word access is the Weasley word, the one that's hard to pin down. I mean, I think that there are probably, I'd guess that 2 billion people have access to this radio program. But that doesn't mean they're listening to it, right?
Right.
So what does it mean to have access to a toilet? Is it within within a half a mile of you? Does it mean that that your family has one on their property? What does it mean to have access to a cell phone? Does it mean if I walk a day out of the wilderness into a village, I might be able to persuade somebody to let me use theirs? There's so many questions about a statistic like that, I find it meaningless.
Which come to think of it, are also used by book publishers and newspaper circulation managers when they think about the pass-through rate. Is that what it's called, where they assume somebody else is going to get a hold of the paper or book at some point?
Yeah, so in magazine subscriptions, what they'll often tell their advertisers is that they have an effective readership of 5 million people. And what they're counting on is that they've got, well, maybe they sell a million copies of the magazine, but they assume that five people read each copy. That after you've read yours, you leave it in a bus station, somebody else picks it up, or it's in a library, or you put it in recycling, somebody picks it out. I guess that they base those claims on surveys, but the numbers are a bit soft.
Mm-hmm, no doubt. A bunch of people want to talk to you. Let's take a call here from Rich in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Daniel Levitin, the author of A Field Guide to Lies. Rich,
hey,
go ahead.
Jeff.
Yeah.
My question is, actually I got two. But the first one is, back in 2000, because this kind of concerned me, that every news organization out there was calling the election for Gore, but then the Fox organization called it for Bush, and it seemed like all of a sudden everybody turned around and said, they all got it wrong. How is it that all those major news organizations could get it wrong and one in particular get it right? Huh. And my second question is, you weren't ever on Saturday Night Live, were you? For some reason, I totally remember your name is Dan the Man Levitin.
Oh, let's find out.
Well, I went to high school with a screenwriter who used my name in the movie Good Morning Vietnam, Dan the Man Levitin. So that might be that, but I know I wasn't on Saturday Night Live yet. polling is really complicated, and there are set ways to do it, but there is room for discretion and judgment on the part of the pollster. You may have read the New York Times a week or two ago took a polling data set and gave it to five different polling organizations. So all of them are using the same data, but the assumptions and the calculations they made ended up with five completely different projections. And this is a topic I love to talk about. Part of the problem is that the kinds of people who will answer a particular poll may not be representative or indicative of the average voter in the country. Stop and think about it. If somebody stopped you in the street and said, I'm taking a poll, you know, what's the likelihood you would stop and talk to them yourself? Or if they call you on the phone while you're in the middle of doing something, or they send you an email survey, the kinds of people who respond may have a particular political leaning, or may not, but that's an issue. If the pollsters try to solicit information over landlines, that's going to tend to secure somewhat people who are older. Cell phones are going to secure people who are somewhat younger. You stop people on the street, you're not getting people who are busy at work. They're walking across the street. So it's very complicated, and that's why we've got a margin of error and why the polls seem to differ from one another.
And in the case of Florida in 2000, I mean, it was so close, it was really hard to get an accurate beat at that point.
Well, you have always a margin of error. The Florida count was well within the margin of error. A lot of the polls are putting Clinton and have put Clinton and Trump, say, 2 points apart, but the polls have a 3% margin of error, meaning that the numbers are actually indistinguishable.
So it's essentially a tie in those polls.
But next time you hear a poll, ask yourself, are they reporting the margin of error? Because if they're not, the number is meaningless.
Ah, okay, good. Good thing to listen for. Let's go to Steve in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Daniel Levitin.
Hello.
Hi.
I think the problem is probably even a little bit more further upstream than critical thinking. I think we have a crisis of epistemology in the 21st century. Epistemology is the branch of philosophy that studies the nature of human belief, and in particular, the validity of human belief. So let's consider these five epistemologies: rationalism, authoritarianism, emotionalism, experientialism, and intuition. Now, most of us are probably influenced by all five of those bases for believing that anything is true, but we stack them differently, and we go to them in a different order. And on top of that is the phenomenon of assimilation, and that is the thing that causes people to liken their beliefs to the beliefs that the social community that they associate with or to people they want approval from. And for some people, that's very powerful. They will completely subjugate their individually held beliefs to those of the group. So critical thinking presumes an epistemology of rationalism. I think once you can get people into that channel and get them to believe that reason should be their beacon for believing that anything is true, then the rest is easy. But epistemological research tends to show us that authoritarianism and emotionalism are much more powerful epistemologies for most people today.
Okay, very, very complete thoughts. Thanks for those, Steve. Appreciate that. Thoughts back from you, Daniel?
Oh, I appreciate that, Steve. And I agree with you. I think that there is a role for emotion and authority in life. And in fact, I devote a section of the book to how and when to appeal to authorities and how to know who an authority is and not blindly follow an expert in one domain just because they were an expert in another. And I think you're right. We need to get people to realize the value of evidentiary-based thinking. And on the topic of epistemology and the limits of human knowledge, I think that there are certainly cases where we have to throw up our hands and say, I don't know. And I talk about a couple of cases like that in the book, one from physics, the Higgs boson, and one from entertainment, David Blaine, the magician, trying to evaluate. I walk through these examples to show how critical thinking can be applied by anybody to figure out whether a claim is true or not. In the case of David Blaine, he has a career as an endurance artist, and so the question is, are these feats of endurance actually athletic feats, or is he just using magic tricks? And in reviewing the evidence carefully, for that and for the Higgs boson, for that matter, I come to the conclusion that there's enough evidence on either side that I can't decide, and many readers may not be able to either, but at least we've got a process in place, and as new evidence comes in, it can help us decide.
So what do you make, then, of particularly when we get into expertise and authority, where we've got this often bandied figure, 97% of scientists believe that human-caused climate change is real? I mean, how do you read that, and are there some flaws in the use of the numbers there?
Well, I've looked into this, and I've tried to keep an open mind. I think that the number of qualified scientists whose area of expertise is climatology, who believe that climate change is real, is even higher than 97%. In that 3% of scientists who are skeptical or actually who deny climate change, I think everybody's skeptical, meaning that we take an evidence-based approach. The 3% who deny climate change, a large number of them tend to be people who don't have experience in climatology. They might be scientists, geneticists, or they might be engineers, but they're not really authorities on the topic.
All right. So, and particularly when we get into things like the coverage of political campaigns and what the candidates have said and what they stand for, I find myself, even as a longtime journalist, realizing that there's a fine line between what is presented as analysis and what is presented as commentary. And, for example, you get the New York Times often saying, well, this throws a shadow over the campaign of whichever person they're talking about that day. That's a rather subjective term.
Yeah. And the New York Times, to their credit, have started doing something, which is that if it's opinion, you'll notice that the typography doesn't have a justified right margin. It's left ragged.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can visually distinguish between an opinion piece and an actual news piece by the typography. That's helpful. And I think that, you know, in a world that's complicated with a lot of information whizzing by, we do want to know what the pundits think. We take in the information as best we can, but oftentimes we want to know, bottom line, you're an expert on this. You've been in the political scene for 20 years. I can't make sense of the data myself because I don't have the training. What's my take home? What do you believe is going on? What is your opinion? And as long as the journalists are keeping straight with us about what's opinion and what's fact, I think that's all fine.
But with the proliferation of news sources in the world today, is it a little harder to find the people that you think you'll trust?
It is. And, of course, I didn't mean to disparage bloggers earlier. There are some very rigorous and authoritative bloggers. It's just, you know, finding who they are and making sure that they're accurate is difficult. But if they cite their sources and you can track down the sources yourself, that's a big step forward.
Well, there's some great tools in here for us to use in applying some tests to bits of knowledge that are placed in front of us to find out whether they really hold water or not. It's called A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. Daniel Levitin wrote it, and he's been our guest on The Exchange today. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
All right, take care.